Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made a losing battle so important in the fight for Texas independence? When William B. Travis, Jim Bowie, and Davy Crockett holed up in the Alamo against the Mexican army in February of 1836, they were outnumbered 10 to 1 and running low on everything from food to ammunition. But while they seemed to have understood they would not survive the battle, the courage of those doomed Texas rebels helped spur their comrades to victory weeks later and remains one of the proudest legacies of Texas history. Author and literary agent James Donovan explores the days of fighting and the events that preceded the siege in his new book, The Blood of Heroes, The 13-Day Struggle for the Alamo and the Sacrifice That Forged a Nation. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
This is such a fascinating story because we all think we know what happened at the Alamo, and yet there are always new details emerging. I'm wondering how much of this was new to you as you began to research.
It's one of the reasons I wanted to do this book on this subject. 4 years ago, I did a book on the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and I was amazed at how much new information I found. And I started that research about 8 years ago, and after doing that book and the research for this, I realized most authors don't really dig very deeply. They use books already published, secondary sources, and I firmly believe you can always find new material on almost anything if you dig deep enough.
Is there that moment when you're in an archive somewhere and you think, I don't think I've read this anywhere. How have I not read this anywhere?
Yes, because if you do your job, do it right, you become very, very familiar with everything that's written. Primary sources, good secondary sources. You live in the end notes, the footnotes, the bibliographies. You get to learn them very well. And when you see something that is new, that might be of value, it's a eureka moment. There's not enough of those. You follow trails down 20 rabbit holes before you find something.
Yeah. Well, let's get a little context here. Talk about how the relationship between the colonists in Mexican Texas and the Mexican government had changed since Mexico gained its independence from Spain.
Right. A lot of people don't understand the situation back then. It was sort of complicated. Most of the settlers, the colonists in Texas at the time, there were about 30 to 35,000. They were happy with statehood. They would have been happy with statehood and the recognition of some basic rights that they weren't really getting at the time, such as habeas corpus, trial by jury, things like that. You probably know this, you read the book. Mexico had only achieved its independence in 1821 from Spain. In 1824, they instituted a liberal democratic constitution, somewhat modeled on ours. And then in 1832, a young general named Santa Anna was elected president, and even Texians applauded. They thought he was going to be their savior and grant them statehood. But a couple of years later, when he was persuaded by primarily the church, landed gentry, and the military, who had all lost power because of all the democratic reforms of the past 8 or 10 years, they persuaded him to change his colors, and he started rolling back democratic reforms, dismissed the Mexican Congress, and called for the Constitution to be revised. And even then, that was 1834, went into 1835, most of them were still, I mean the Texas colonists, most of them were for statehood. It was only when he put down another uprising in Zacatecas, because we forget that in about half of the 19 Mexican states at the time, there were uprisings when he started doing all this in 1834. And in Zacatecas, in May 1835, Santa Anna led an army of 4,000 or 5,000 men against a similar number of Zacatecas militia, wiped them out, very bloody battle, and then organized an army of 6,000 men to march north into Texas. They were next. It was only then that the Texas colonists realized that independence was the only way out.
So how credible were Santa Anna's fears that the United States had designs on invading Mexico?
I don't think very credible, although several presidents before Andrew Jackson, who was in power at the time, had made offers, either official or unofficial, at least three of them, to Mexico for Texas since the days of James Madison, actually. But I haven't seen any evidence that they were planning any kind of invasion, although he was furious that United States colonists, United States citizens, rather, were streaming into Texas, which, of course, was a part of Mexico at the time, part of the state of Coahuila y Texas. He was furious that there were so many of them coming in and demanding all these rights that they were used to, having had been used to a republic, or rather a democracy, for almost 60 years, and the rest of Mexico weren't really on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And so after a while, was it 1830 that Americans were no longer allowed legally to immigrate into Mexico? Mexican Texas, I should say.
Right, right. That immigration law lasted for a while, although it didn't really stop the steady stream of illegal immigrants just flowing into the country and just in the old time-honored American way of just grabbing land and setting up house.
What do the Americans want with Texas?
You mean the American colonists? Well, at the time when this started, when Mexico granted these empresarios such as Stephen F. Austin and maybe a couple of dozen others, although no one was as successful as Stephen Austin, they gave them huge swaths of Texas land and gave them the right to bring in citizens for nominal fees that were something like a tenth of the price of land in the United States. So, which is, you know, back then it was an agrarian society. 8 of 10 men worked the land. If you didn't have land, you were nobody. Suffrage laws were only then being eradicated that insisted on, you know, ownership of land. So it was still, the mindset was still there. So that was the big reason. Most of them were from the southern states, of course, because they were contiguous.
Austin's an interesting character because he was very much sort of fulfilling the wishes of his dead father.
His father, Moses Austin, had some experience at that. Just before the War of 1812, with a small portion of Mexico that bordered Louisiana. It didn't last very long. It was all wiped out by the War of 1812, and he got the idea in the about 1819, 1820, he was going to do the same thing, Moses Austin. So he went to Mexico City, got a grant from the Spanish government, went home, but the trip home was so arduous, he died a few months later on his deathbed. Supposedly, he begged his son, Stephen F. Austin, to take over his plans as an impresario in Texas.
Okay, so the Texas rebels called themselves Texians, and it was mostly Anglo-American immigrants, but they were people who had been born into Mexican culture as well. Talk a little bit about, they had ejected the Mexican army not too long before the Alamo battle took place.
Mm-hmm. Texians, the term Texians, you see more than any other by far. Of course, that was shortened to Texans soon later. And although we use the word Tejanos now, that wasn't used at the time. People just called them Mexicans, really. But, you know, we think of them as people living in Texas, Texans of Mexican descent at the time, I suppose. There were, I think I've mentioned, between 30 and 35,000 people living in Texas at the time. Most of those were Anglo colonists, probably 28,000 to 30,000. Hard to be exact. Maybe a few thousand, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 Tejanos, as we call them now, and maybe 2,000 or 3,000 slaves. Let's not forget those.
And they were illegal. Slavery was illegal in Mexico, but the Texans European Texans just ignored that.
Slavery was illegal in Mexico at the time. It was legal, of course, in the United States. And a lot of these colonists were Southern citizens. Now, 2,000 to 3,000 might sound like a lot, but I don't think it's that many when you think that 25 years later, in 1861, there were more than 180,000 slaves in Texas alone. So slavery, which some people today think was one of the major causes of the revolution, I don't think it was. Neither does Randolph Campbell, who wrote a book called An Empire of Slavery about Texas and slavery. He terms it an underlying cause of the revolution. Yes, they were illegal, but you could get your slaves in by declaring them indentured servants. There was a way to do that. You'd get them to sign their X, and what were they going to do? They were slaves. Bring them in. And the Mexican government looked the other way mostly anyway. They were hundreds and hundreds of miles south in Mexico City, and very little law of the Mexican type in Texas. And so slaves were commonly bought, sold, advertised in the few Texian newspapers.
And this was, in fact, how Jim Bowie began to build his wealth.
Yeah, that scoundrel. He, in Louisiana, he had made and lost several fortunes. He had two or three brothers that he worked, did a lot of these things with. He started, did a few other things, the timber industry, but he soon got into slave smuggling, which was illegal at the time, even in the United States, and made quite a fortune doing that. Also did a lot of land forgery. Anytime you've got an area of land like Louisiana that has passed through different owners over this short amount of time, you've got all sorts of confusion, much all the easier to forge things and make money off it. At one time, he owned hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres of Louisiana land if they had been declared legal. But the United States Attorney General got suspicious and started investigating, and that was about the time that Mr. Bowie, Big Jim, decided he'd seek newer land, fresher land, and went west to Texas about 1830, 1831.
And it didn't take him long, I guess, to get involved in the rebel activities. I also want to talk a little bit about William B. Travis, because I think I knew a little bit about him. I knew he had a checkered past, but an interesting one. I did not realize he was 26 years old when this all took place.
Seems so young, 26. Yeah. He was a very smart, cultured man, especially for that time. Let's face it, you know, a lot of Texas, most of it was the frontier at the time. He was a lawyer, had started his own newspaper in Alabama at the age of 19, at the same time as he was trying to make his way as a lawyer, put out his own shingle. Got married at 19 to a woman named Rosanna Cato. They had a small boy soon, but he accrued a lot of debts, and in, I believe, 1831, slunk out of Alabama, went to Texas, GTT, gone to Texas. He was one of those. And Texas was known as a place you could start a new life, and he promised he would send for them or come get them. Rosanna was pregnant at the time with what would become a little girl. He never did. Eventually, a few years later, they agreed to a divorce. Back then, divorces weren't easy. It had to go through the government. He was waiting for a divorce. He had fallen in love in between, about a year or so before all this, the Battle of the Alamo, with a woman named Rebecca Cummins, and they were waiting for the divorce to go through when the Alamo occurred.
My guest is James Donovan, author and literary agent. His new book is called The Blood of Heroes, The 13-Day Struggle for the Alamo and the Sacrifice That Forged a Nation. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James Donovan. He's a literary agent and author of the new book, The Blood of Heroes, The 13-Day Struggle for the Alamo and the Sacrifice That Forged a Nation. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So not long before the Battle of the Alamo was the Battle of Behar, I suppose was how it was said back then.
Right, Behar.
Surprising setback for the Mexican government.
It's an interesting battle that very few people know about. When the Mexican government started cracking down and instituting certain restrictions on the Texas colonists that they weren't happy about, taking their cannon, there were even plans to take some of their weapons, and
such parallels, by the way, to the Revolutionary War.
Oh, all the time. These men considered themselves sons of 76. They thought of it all the time. George III, Santa Ana, what's the difference? But they sent from Behar, San Antonio de Behar, which was a center of the unspoken capital of Texas at the time, sent 100 men to confiscate a small six-pound cannon, which means it shot a six-pound ball, from Gonzales, 75 miles east, which was a small settlement in the DeWitt colony. And that didn't go well. Militia from units from other places in Texas made it there very quickly, and there was a slight skirmish. Maybe one man was killed. They had orders not to create a large disturbance if there was any resistance, so the Mexican soldiers went back to Behar. Stephen F. Austin was beseeched to come lead them. He came and led what turned out to be several hundred colonists, a ragged army. They called themselves the Army of the People, 75 miles west to Behar. They surrounded the city. They were at the time maybe 700 soldiers, Mexican soldiers, and a few thousand people that live there. And finally, oh boy, infighting, all sorts of problems with this you know, ramshackle army. They were about to call it off, go home. Everybody was giving up, tired of it after about 2 months. It was getting cold when a man named Benjamin Milam, showed up from a scout and realized what was happening and said the famous, "Who will go with old Ben Milam into San Antonio?" And a few hundred men cheered and followed him. And the next morning, they, very early, about 3 or 4 o'clock, they ran down cornfields from north of town into the town and secured a few houses. And over the next 4 days, it was house to house, sometimes room to room, fighting the Mexican army. And eventually, I think on the morning of December 5th, they won. The Mexican army under General Cos surrendered, and a few days later trekked south into Mexico. And those were the last soldiers in Mexico. And a lot of colonists thought, oh, well, that'll be it. They've learned their lesson. They'll just leave us alone. They won't send any more soldiers in. We can get on with trying to, you know, lobby for statehood. And, of course, we know what happened.
So there must be dozens of Ben Milam elementary schools scattered throughout the state of Texas. I didn't know till I read the book that he was all but illiterate.
He was. He was from Kentucky, I think. Very interesting man. He was an impresario at the time, but they usually had, they were required to bring in X amount of colonists in a certain amount of time, and he never got that done. He was quite an adventurer, quite an interesting man. He was killed on the second or third day of the battle, one of only about 8 or 9 men killed. And they buried him right there in San Antonio, and just a few years ago, they dug up his body and did some forensic investigations on it and found some fascinating things, him being arthritic, things like that.
So talk about the men who were stationed at the Alamo and what they were expecting and how they were provisioned when the Mexicans began to approach.
The men of the Alamo. Most of them were volunteers. They had gone there over the last few months with different leaders like Bowie or Travis or even Davy Crockett, or had been stationed there after Behar, the Battle of Behar, and remained there. About 100 men stayed there. That was reduced to about 60 at some point after, because they kept on waiting for it. These were just volunteers that had signed up for a few months, and they said they'd wait for the regular army. A regular army, never more than about 50 men ever were part of the actual regular army. These colonists hated signing up and following all the rules and regulations of an actual army. They liked to just form in companies and elect their own colonels or captains. So they eventually, after a couple months, from December through January, early February, mid-February, they reached about 160, 170 men, some of whom were injured, maybe 20, 25, 30. And when Santa Anna's army showed up on the afternoon, early afternoon of February 23rd from the west side of town, they made their way fairly quickly into this Alamo on the other side of the river, out on the outskirts of town at the time. An old Franciscan mission that had been abandoned by them in 1793, and then a few years later had become a fort, which the Mexicans used. And they had maybe 40 or 50 beeves and lots of corn. I think something like, 70 or 80 bushels of corn.
Let me interrupt here. There's a great scene in the book of realizing the Mexicans are coming and herding as many cattle as they possibly can inside the walls of the colony.
Right, exactly. And Travis actually gave the owner of that a receipt, which has come to light recently. So, and the same thing for the bushels of corn. He was pretty good at that. So that's what they had for about, at the time, before the Gonzales 32 made it in a few days later and made the contingent about 200 men and about 15 or 20 women and children that were mostly in the church that had come in with them, relatives, wives, things like that. That's all they had. And after a while, it got pretty monotonous. And of course, the sanitary conditions, you can imagine.
Yeah, and I don't know whether those sanitary conditions contributed at all to the illness that felled Jim Bowie essentially before the fighting even really got underway.
Well, he had been, what a fascinating character, you know, the legendary knife fighter on Southwest, the frontier. He was led a very active life. And after his sandbar fight of 1827, which I couldn't resist leading off his chapter on because it was so much fun
very
to write
exciting.
About. Yeah. Where he got, you know, attacked at different times by several men with sword canes, with knives, with a shot.
A bullet through his entire body.
Through his entire body, through one of his lungs, through his hand. But he recovered. It took him a while, but I don't think he was the same after that. And his lungs especially were probably weakened. So we don't know exactly what he came down with. It was probably what everybody... Conclusion is some kind of a combination of typhoid and pneumonia, which was common at the time. Now, a lot of people nowadays, it's become generally perceived that he came down after they moved in, but I think he came down with that about a week before they moved in, so about February 15th or 16th, because his anything with his name on it just disappears after that time.
It's all right. We were sort of talking about what they had with them and how they were provisioned. So they recognize that everything is going to get very bad. The Mexican army is approaching and sort of inching closer and closer, particularly at night. William B. Travis sends for reinforcements, and he sends for them to Goliad, where James Fannin is in charge.
Right. The lines at that time were kind of porous. They were surrounded, but it wasn't... It wasn't a solid line of men. There were about 1,500 Mexican soldiers from February 23rd who arrived then with Santa Anna until about February 4th, when 1,000 more that he asked for reinforcements showed up, because the rest of his 6,000-man army was on the back trail. They were scattered along for hundreds of miles. So at that time, there were 1,500 or 1,600. At the time of the battle, probably about 2,500.
And then so they're there and they start to approach, and Travis knows that he has no shot.
Right. Well, the lines were porous. These regiments of soldiers were camped around on the plains around San Antonio, but couriers could get through. And he sent several out. He sent a few east to Gonzales for those messages to be sent. Another 75 miles to San Felipe, which was Stephen F. Austin's center, the center of Stephen F. Austin's grant, and then where the provisional government was hanging out. And then Washington, which was a little city on the little town on the Brazos, beseeching them for, of course, provisions, reinforcements, ammunition. They were short on all of this. He sent a few to Goliad, which was 95 miles down the San Antonio River, roughly southeast, where there was a presidio that had been taken over by a man named James Fannin, a colonel. I believe he had gone to West Point for a short, very short time, only a couple of years, hadn't graduated. And he had about 400 men or so. And he was somewhat wishy-washy. When he first got the first message, he organized about 300 men, and they were going to march north and reinforce Travis. But they got across the river there, maybe a quarter of a mile, and oxen carts started breaking down. It was the middle of the afternoon, so they camped there. Next morning, they had a little confab on the banks of the river and decided, you know, I think we should just stay here and protect this place. So they never made, not one man made it from Goliad up there. They had their own problems, of course, and when they were finally ordered to fall back east, that took way too long also. Days and days after he got those orders, it was days before they left, and they were caught on Toledo Creek, maybe 20, 30 miles or even less than that, east of Goliad.
Is it reasonable to assume that if Fannin had responded with a full measure of men to the call for help from the Alamo, that the Texans would have prevailed there?
Santa Anna's intelligence organization was pretty good. There were a lot of course, what we might call Tories, Mexicans, who supported Santa Anna. And of course, especially since he was there at the time, they might have not supported him before he got there. But
it's so strange to think about a sitting president going and taking part.
Yeah, right. But, you know, he was an interesting character because he hated statecraft and just actually loved to be on the trail. What he really liked to be was returning and, you know, gathering the garlands and the adulation.
Resting on his laurels.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. But his intelligence organization was, I mean, it wasn't very organized, but he had lots of men informing. And so he knew that there was a force from Goliad preparing to move north. And he sent out a few nights after arriving in San Antonio and surrounding the Alamo, he sent out a force, mostly cavalry, south to meet them. They waited a while and came back the next day. So I don't think that he might have made it in. He might have moved north with about 300 men, would have taken some losses meeting that force, and maybe more. Santa Anna might have sent reinforcements down there. I rather doubt that he would have made it into the Alamo with many men. And it would have, to make a difference in the final battle, I think it would have taken somewhere around 500 men to man all the walls.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Arlington, where we have Carl on the line. Hi, Carl.
Hi. This is for James. First, a little data. I had two of my family at San Jacinto. I am from San Antonio, and my father lived during the period when Juan Seguin was there. Also, Arlington is the only city in the state that has a Juan Seguin High School. But here's a question. Since Juan Seguin was the only person who left the Alamo without a message or any indication that he was a person trying to get help while he left, and looking at Juan Seguin's history in his life after that occurrence, it seemed likely that he was not a messenger. He just left the Alamo. And the secondary issue is it appears to me the Alamo really wasn't under siege. They were trying to get people to come to the Alamo from Texas so they wouldn't have to chase them all over Texas, because they knew they had the wherewithal to defeat just about any enemy because of Koss's effort there, and he had been at the Alamo earlier and retreated.
And well, so Carl, you've raised a lot of interesting points. Let's see if we can get a response for you on those issues.
Carl, you bring up some interesting points, and I've seen those arguments made in different places. I guess there's the possibility that Juan Seguin, what you're saying is he might have had some ulterior motives, but I think it's pretty well established and believed by historians that he left as one of the couriers to try to, you know, find some reinforcements or persuade the government or somebody to send some reinforcements. He told several different accounts of how he got out, when he got out, what he did. I think I determined that he headed towards Goliad, met some men from Goliad, a couple of men on their way north, gave them the information. They went back to Goliad. Then he moved east toward Gonzales and met up with some colonists there who were preparing to march to the aid of the Alamo.
My guest is author and literary agent James Donovan. His new book is called The Blood of Heroes, The 13-Day Struggle for the Alamo and the Sacrifice That Forged a Nation. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. James Donovan is my guest. He's a literary agent and author of the new book, The Blood of Heroes, The 13-Day Struggle for the Alamo and the Sacrifice That Forged a Nation. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So we had a question earlier that touched on perhaps the loyalty or disloyalty of Juan Seguin, but we also have this issue of William B. Travis and his famous line in the sand. And in fact, the only person who didn't willingly cross that line was Moses Rose, as far as we know.
There are two major points of controversy in this book, of course. Everybody asks me about that. And then, of course, how did Davy die?
We'll get to that.
Okay. The line, I think a good portion of people today think of the line as maybe a myth or a legend. In researching this book, I found new evidence that I think points to the reality of the line, that it really happened. And I found enough that I decided to write an afterword, 24-page afterword, presenting all the evidence about it and analyzing it and coming to a conclusion. The Frenchman was, his name was Louis Rose. He was called Moses because he was an older man. He was about 50, had fought with Napoleon at the time. Might have been a friend of Bowie's, at least was from the same area, lived over in Nacogdoches and came west and fought at Bayer and stayed there and decided from the accounts we have that when Travis drew this line And Travis was an extremely dramatic man. He had grown up on Sir Walter Scott and Jane Porter's The Scottish Chiefs. And of course, he was a lot of Scots in him and identified with this. And he was very dramatic. And it was perfectly in character for him to draw this line, either the night before or maybe the night before that, and say, you know, whoever wants to fight with me, step over it. If anyone doesn't, you know, now's the time to get out. And Rose later told people that he just wasn't ready to die and climbed the wall and snuck out, snuck down the river, San Antonio River, headed east, and eventually told his story to some people.
Hmm. It's hard to believe that he was allowed to go, first of all, and then that he was willing to admit that story.
You're exactly right. I mean, that's a very good point. They were almost all volunteers. Travis's 30 horsemen, his cavalry, his, quote, legion of cavalry, which he was ordered to raise. He could only raise about 30 and was very embarrassed and begged not to have to go to the Alamo when he was told to do so by Governor Henry Smith. People forget that he really didn't want to be there. He wasn't really a glory hog of that type. He wanted to be where they were making the law. If he had lived, there's no doubt in my mind that he would have been a major player in Texas politics for years. He was only 26 at the time.
So before we get to Davy Crockett's death, or we should say David Crockett, because that is what he would have called himself in a formal situation. Before we get to that, tell us what we can know about the last day of the battle.
Well, the farther you go back in history, the harder it is, of course, because there are, especially before the advent of electronic recording devices at the end of the 19th century, we have to rely on hearsay. And, of course, when you're talking about a battle like this where everybody on one side dies, essentially, except Travis's slave, Joe, one Mexican soldier who actually persuaded Santa Anna's soldiers that he had been captured and was on their side, and they let him live, actually. And, of course, 15 or 20 women and children, but they were in the church.
They weren't watching the battle.
They were in there just listening to it. So what they told us is very limited. Susanna Dickinson, of course, the most famous one, the only Anglo survivor, left a few accounts. But she could only hear and surmise. So what we had, and remember that the assault started at either 5 or 5:30. It was still dark for a while. These Mexican soldiers and officers didn't know any of these men. They didn't know, of course, they knew that Bowie was in there and maybe Crockett and Travis from people in town who told them. But they didn't know who these people were by sight.
Right.
It was before photography was invented. Even woodcuts in papers. They had never seen any American papers. Very unlikely. So they didn't know any of these men. It was dark. This was black powder, you know, very smoky. They left some, there's a few very terse after-action accounts. Some of them wrote accounts later. So what we have is limited. What we don't have are the personal stories of the defenders who did what. We have to, you know, we have to surmise from what we do know that they probably did, and they probably did that. So that's disappointing. But we know a decent amount of how the battle generally progressed from the accounts of the primarily Mexican officers and maybe a couple of sergeants.
So what happened to Davy Crockett?
Well, some people over the last few decades have tried to put forth say that he was executed. He was taken before Santa Anna after the battle with between four and six other men, so a total of five and seven men, and he was one of these men, and was executed. Santa Anna told the officer who brought them up, "There are no prisoners. Execute them," and that was done. And people today who make that point often say, "Well, there are five or six officer accounts and one sergeant account who prove that. And when you hear that, it sounds impressive.
From the Mexican side,
yes. I mean, that sounds impressive on the face of it. Wow, 5 or 6 officers said this and a sergeant. Well, when you examine these things very closely, they kind of fall apart for a lot of reasons. Some of them are just plain silly. There's one that says, I think it's by the sergeant, that says he walked into a room of the Alamo where Travis was counting wads of money and Crockett was taking a nap on the floor, and they got up, and it gets sillier after that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of these Mexican officer accounts.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Jim in Carrollton. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
James, I just had a question. What is your opinion on this? Did the settlers who went to Texas go there with the intention of breaking away from Mexico?
No, I don't think they did. I think they were happy enough as Mexican citizens because the Mexican government left them alone. They, you know, the impresarios set up their own kind of mini governments with alcaldes who were mayors and, you know, things like that. And they were left alone to work the land. Most of them didn't have much money when they got there, but they had nice, you know, grants of land. A man could get 4,424 acres of land, a Mexican or Spanish league at the time, which is a lot of land, of course. And I don't think they did at the time. And I think that's proven by the fact that, you know, until Santa Anna began marching into Texas with 5,000 or 6,000 men, they were still arguing about. There was a war party, war dogs that were for independence, but the majority of Texans were still, you know, for statehood.
So talk about why the Alamo was so important. Certainly it mobilized this great sentiment, the tragedy at the Alamo, and to a lesser extent the defeat the Texians suffered at Goliad. But what made those 13 days so critical?
And before I forgot to sort of conclude about David Crockett.
Forgive me, sometimes people take a breath and I just jump
right
on.
No, it's my fault. It's possible that he was executed, but I doubt it because several Santa Anna and several other Mexican officers who were there, high ranking, wrote accounts later. Even Santa Anna's secretary, Ramon Caro, wrote accounts later, never mentioned David Crockett being one of them. And I think Santa Anna would have loved to have mentioned that because he just hated the United States and the fact that Texas was getting support from the United States.
Would have been a big score to mention.
Absolutely. So it's a possibility, but I just don't think it happened. Now, as far as
the importance of the Alamo in terms of this fight for independence and what happened at San Jacinto six months later.
Before San Jacinto, most of the, at the time of the Alamo, the two large forces of colonists that were kind of part of the volunteer army were at the Alamo, 200 or so, and at Goliad, about maybe 400, and 3/4 of them were volunteers. It took the Alamo, the destruction of those 200 men, and the massacre at Goliad to fire up the Texas colonists to, you know, come to the standards and fight for their independence. They hadn't before. After Béjar, they had gone home, taken care of their farms. They thought that was it. And it was hard getting them involved after that until those. So that's one thing. And also, Santa Anna's army spent about at least two weeks at the Alamo. On the 13th day of the siege, the attack occurred. And several days after that, he stayed there getting his forces ready to move east. And those 2 to 2.5 or 3 weeks were very important because there was essentially no Mexican army. Texian army at the time. So that enabled, once the news reached the Anglo settlements to the east, that enabled Houston to gather several hundred men, which reached maybe 1,100, 1,200 at certain times. A lot, very fluid, of course. And also, of course, the Mexicans, once they started moving east about 2 or 3 weeks later, the rains came and that slowed them down even more. So I think it's much more important, those two events, the massacre at Goliad and the destruction of the force at the Alamo, really played a larger part than people think, or at least today, in the success, the ultimate success at San Jacinto.
Was that a sneak attack by the Texians, essentially?
At
San Jacinto.
Well, I guess you could say that the Mexicans really didn't expect it, since some of them were taking a siesta. It was about 4 p.m. Kind of hard to really call it a 100% sneak attack when they were about, you know, less than a mile across the field in plain sight. And, you know, they had both been camped there for about at least a full day. That was kind of an amazing route, about 950 Texians running across the field against between 1,100, 1,200, 1,300 Mexicans. And, of course, maybe at the most 8 or 9 Texians died ultimately, and 650 at least Mexicans were killed.
So everyone who tells this story wants to get at the things that are myths, or I should say most people with an eye toward true history want to get at the myths and overturn them and make sure we have the truth. Do you think, though, is there value to the stories that we have fabricated or exaggerated about the Alamo, or is there only value to the pure history?
Oh, such a tough question. Come on.
This is what I give people for the last 90 seconds.
Right. Yeah. Well, when I do a book, I want to get to the truth, so I in a way, I don't really give much thought to, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, myths and legends are important in a lot of ways. And boy, I'm just dancing around this question, aren't I?
Well, I won't hold you to the fire, but talk a little bit about, I know that you work with other authors. When you began writing yourself, and this is not your first book, was it a totally different process than you imagined it would be, having worked with so many other authors as their agent?
Absolutely. I'm much more empathetic now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can you can sympathize with authors if you haven't written clinically, maybe, mm-hmm. and intellectually. But unless you've had a contract and a deadline, most importantly, a deadline, you've taken some money for it, so you owe this. I mean, it's a huge debt, and it's like a sword hanging over your head as the deadline nears, which is the reason I think authors, some of them are heavy drinkers and, you know, go crazy, and very few of them actually meet their deadlines. And now I really empathize with them a lot more easily.
Well, you got it out on time, and you seem to be sober and in good shape.
Well, so. It wasn't really on time. It was supposed to be out earlier, but it's out when it's out.
The new book by James Donovan is called The Blood of Heroes, The 13-Day Struggle for the Alamo and the Sacrifice That Forged a Nation. Jim, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
I've loved it. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the daily podcast. It's free at kera.org/think. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.